Hi everyone, and welcome to the Cover Mindset podcast with McGinley Coaching. I'm your host and founder, Laurie McGinley. Today we're joined by Ella Williams. How are you, Ella?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Oh, I'm good, thank you. Can you just tell the listeners about a background of yourself and the kind of the journey you've been on? From like the film to like the coaching to the kind of grassroots kind of things you're doing at the moment?
Yes, so my background is really in football in terms of grassroots football, coaching, playing. I've sort of been involved in football in that respect since the age of about 10. I currently run a business, Argol, which I set up in the July of last year, actually, which is a not-for-profit organisation whose vision is to empower every girl to be active and to reach her full potential. So we do that through community football sessions and also through mentoring with the teenage girls that are most disengaged with PE. So those girls that are not turning up to PE, not taking the PE kit in, we use that PE slot to co-construct a programme with the girls to try and basically eventually re-engage them, but help to rebuild the positive relationships with sport and physical activity. I previously worked on the film Copper 71, which came out on International Women's Day this year on the 8th of March. Copper 71, if anyone's not seen it, has actually been in cinemas for like, well, since then, 3-4 weeks now. Copper 71 tells the story of the highest attended women's sporting event in history that nobody's ever heard of, which is the 1971 Women's World Cup, the final of which had 110,000 fans. So it's a world record. We'll actually be going into this year's Guinness World Records. So yeah, I worked as a researcher on that film, which was amazing. We like travelled around the world and met all of the women that took part in this World Cup. And that was really something that aligned with me and my values and my passion. Everything that I do is driven by my passion that is for empowering women and girls through sport and physical activity and giving every girl the opportunity to help break down the barriers that they face to getting involved.
So let's start back at the kind of start, you know, working with the kind of, because you see a lot of girls struggle sometimes with when it's kind of more male dominated sports, but also in PE, because I remember when I was my school, I had 3 girls and 25 boys, you know, and it was, but the best thing about it was one of the girls that was in my class is actually Lee Alexander, the Scottish international women's player, and you know, such a fantastic role model to, you know, to look at. But just from your, you said that you kind of do PE lessons, try and help the kind of engage, but how do you try and engage more girls to do more physical activity? Because there seems to be more and more girls and kind of women in the kind of doing physical activity, but it's sometimes there's a fear, you know, from like setbacks to, you know, judgments to different things. How do you try and implement a kind of a safe space, but also a confidence? Because you see sometimes they go for one and they enjoy it, but then there's the, they might be you know, scared of going again because they might get some kind of, there's kind of some judgment, or there could be a, you know, again, a setback through financial, through different things, you know, maybe some social, you know, anxiety too. Do you try and build it with kind of girls and then kind of female teachers, or is it very much, you know, try and mix it up? Because I know there's a lot of male teachers and male staff really, really work well with you girls and, you know, young women. I'm just wondering what the kind of curriculum and how the kind of all works.
Yeah, so my sessions particularly, I work with the girls rather than the teachers. This is kind of like an intervention with the girls that otherwise might not be attending PE, or they might be going in and not participating in PE. And the way that we, obviously, like, this is not a quick, there's no quick fix to try and engage these girls in PE, because there's deep-rooted reasons why they're not doing it at the moment. And I think to understand that, you have to understand what the barriers are that these girls are facing, and you mentioned loads of them there. It might be the fear of being judged. That's a massive one in girls, the fear of, you know, doing something and not doing it quite right. It might be the fear, it might be a negative self-body image. You know, if we're thinking about secondary school and teenage girls, these are years where actually girls and women's bodies are changing absolutely loads, and then they're put in situations, for example, where they might need to wear a PE kit that may not actually be designed for girls. It might be a boys kit, but it's just like called a unisex one, and they have to go into changing rooms. Like, they're put into situations that heighten all of these barriers that they're facing. And so with the intervention that I do, there's a lot of things that you can change and a lot of things that you can't change. So in terms of PE, like, you know, one of the things that a lot of the girls struggle with is the other people in the class feeling like they're being sort of looked at and judged, as we said. You cannot change how many children are in a PE class. If there's 30 children in a PE class, that's just how it is. And you can't necessarily change the activities that are being done because, you know, not every child is going to be able to choose what activity they're doing all the time in PE. There's elements that you can change there. Can you give girls some form of choice, some form of agency to take a little bit of, I suppose, decision-making power over what the activity is that they're going to do and try and make that something that's engaging for them and aligns with what they want to do. But what you can change with those girls is trying to boost their own confidence and self-esteem, because that way, when they are in that PE space, at least they will start to feel slightly more confident in themselves to be back in the space where you cannot change all of the elements there. So yeah, it's really working with the girls about building their confidence and self-esteem in like a sporting physical activity space.
And you look at sport, obviously football's probably the number one sport in Scotland and England and probably in the UK, but you've also got different sports. You look at, I know that the, you know, you've got the RBS Six Nations Women's Six Nations on, you've got, I watch, I've seen an attendance for the Caledonia Gladiators women, you know, it was a high attendance again. But do you think that people put like football's the number one thing, but then see when you've got maybe 90% want to play football and 10% want to do something else, you know, like the like a different sport, how do you try and help the ones that are in the kind of minority and then the majority? Because sometimes you've got, as I say, like 90% want to go and play football, but you've got different levels, you know, and it's great having different levels because sometimes it's good to learn from different people. But it's just more, you said about like sometimes the barriers are, you know, these things, but sometimes the barriers actually are sometimes the sport they're in, you know, like they might be a sport they might not be interested in because it might be too competitive, maybe too physical, you know. How do you try and help the ones that maybe struggle with sport as such, you know? Do you try and implement a different style or introduce them to a new sport that they might like? Because I know in PE you've got, there's usually six or seven sports that kids usually like, but sometimes there's one or two that people gravitate to and there's one or two that people don't like. How do you try and help the ones that maybe just struggle, they like sport but they don't really know what sport they want to do?
I think there's a few things there, like talking about football, because, you know, as you mentioned, like, obviously, it's a very popular sport. Football is also a sport where if you throw a load of people in a room that, and usually the ones that will be more skilled will be the ones that are more experienced, which is usually boys. Football's a sport where if you don't have, like, the, I guess you could call it, like, the physical literacy to understand, like, how to pass the ball, how to receive the ball. It's actually very intimidating as a sport because it's not a skill that you would naturally pick up. Like if you are, for example, a girl that's never had a ball kicked to her before, if there's a ball flying around a football pitch, like it's quite an intimidating space for a girl that's never played before to be in. So I think football's one that, like, if you're not already involved in it or experienced in it, it's really excluding of the people, of those people that are at like a beginner's or entry level. I think that where possible, it's about giving all of the children choice. So even if you're in the minority, at some point you'll get to make a decision on what sport you do, but also a variety of opportunities and not necessarily the traditional sports. Like there's so many benefits to team sport, and obviously like football's the one that I would always go back to as being really important sport for all children because of all those characteristics that it develops. But actually, I think there's a movement now away from sport as such and towards movement and physical activity. And actually, the important thing about PE is to get children moving. Like, it might be the only time in the week that a lot of them actually move around. And so if you can do anything that is engaging the young people, I think that's a good thing. So, I don't know, there's so many different options, but I think there can also be a move away from, like, the traditional team sport and a move towards sport that's not necessarily assessed, but it's a sport, it's an activity or a movement that engages children. I don't know, like in my sessions we do wellbeing walks, for example, so we'll like just go on a walk and talk, and actually like it's getting the girls moving, and even though it's not kicking a ball around a football pitch, like, it's better than where they were, and it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, because I do a lot of research in the kind of, as you say, like, well-being, but also, like, the kind of younger kids, you know, like, I do, like, see if, like, instead of, like, a run in the pitch, you know, it's like, can we play tag? Can we do some things like invasion games? Because if you do, like, invasion games, you're creating 1v1s, 2v2s, you know, it's like the hidden fitness side of it, but you're actually doing, like, player kind of profile too. You've got the tall girl versus the small girl, you know, like, how do you... But then you look at you relate it back to the football, that's a striker versus defender. How does the striker get away from the defender? And vice versa. And I'm just, a lot of this is more interesting, you say, like, a lot of movement work, you know, and we try and help the younger kids, you know, like, doing a lot of, I know there's sometimes there's the advantage of, you know, working girls and with girls, but it's also having maybe the younger ones working with boys and girls, you know, mixed, so therefore that kind of, there is a bit of the competitiveness, you know, from the girls and the boys, but also the movement, because they're all very similar, you know, movements, you know, when they're kind of younger. But do you think that's a good thing, having them together sometimes, you know, as a kind of mixed group, but then take sometimes good in having separate sessions too, so therefore they can feel, I don't say, they can feel confident in themselves that they can compete with the boys and compete with the same the girls, but also there's that other part of the social part sometimes is the best part of the day for them. I'm just wondering how you think of these things.
Yeah, that like co-education, boys and girls together debate, I think is a huge one, and I don't exactly know what my answer is on that. I think everyone's got a different view on this, and I also think it depends on the age, definitely. Mm-hmm. Like, I think as girls get older, generally there's a move that they'll start to feel more comfortable, and this is a generalization, it won't be all of them, but the majority will feel more comfortable in a girl only space, and that's particularly when you are taking part in sports where the boys might be physically stronger, they might be more experienced. It increases the barriers that the girls face, and it means that they're not going to necessarily give it their all, perform to the best. It just is like an extra sort of, I suppose, an extra barrier there for the girls. But I actually like what you said about a bit of a mix, like sometimes having a co-ed session, sometimes having a single sex session, because I think that PE is actually the most important lesson at school, because it's one where I think we just play out like socialization in PE, like it's the most realistic representation of what life is. Like, the rest of school obviously is very important, but you know, you're sitting in a classroom, you're learning, you listen to your teacher, and actually PE is a space where we learn to interact with others, and I think sport in that sense is what teaches you the most about life. And so of course the most representative thing of the real world is having boys and girls in the same space. I just think that as girls get older, it's important to sort of also have those protected female-only spaces alongside the boys and girls space.
Yeah. So you talk about sport, you know. Don't worry, I love dogs too. So Ella's dog just can walk in. But you talk about sport life, you know, and you do a lot of research. This is what I was interested in, because I wanted to reach out to you about this film. You know, because I've done a lot of it. I've been working in football for 15 to 20 years now. And this is the first time a couple of weeks ago I heard about this, and it was really interesting because it took such a big hype in social media, you know, with lots of kind of famous, you know, faces. But you know, the biggest thing I've seen now is when you look at these things, there's also a team, people around to support, like the kind of video, to research, to, you know, talking to different people to get things set up. Doing the research must have been probably the hardest thing, but the most rewarding, you know, because if you said nobody's heard of this, now it's got a world record, there must have been so much information out there that people didn't know about, but now are getting too used to it because of the last maybe 3-4 years, maybe I would say maybe 5 years of kind of girls and women's football is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, you know, from probably 2019 in France, you know, how they kind of from Scotland, you know, from, and then you've got the obviously the demise sometimes of the US, you know, then you've got the European teams coming in, you know, coming through. But just wondering, from your research, how did you start it, you know, and what's the kind of protocol, you know, of going to do these things, because it must be, when you get approached to do a project, it must be really exciting, but also quite daunting, you know, because it's a bit unknown, but you know that you've got the backing, but you just need to know where to go and who to speak to. And my second part is, you probably, as I say, you probably spoke to a lot of people and very open about things, but probably felt there was a lot of struggles, you know, back then, because I know that there was a ban, you know, in the FA for 50 years. How do you try and basically make things, make this happen, you know, with it, with you, but also the team of people around you? I'm sorry, that's about 3-4 questions there.
I'll try and remember all of those. So the film went into production in 2022. Yeah, so we did there was 12 months of production, basically, June 22 to June 23. And when we started, I say nobody had heard of it. There was probably literally a handful of people that had heard of this. It was a couple of history books had been written about the history of women's football, and they spoke about this unofficial, what was called unofficial World Cup. But there was no Wikipedia page. Like, you couldn't really Google it. There was nothing on Google. So, yeah, in that sense, the enormity of the task was quite overwhelming at the beginning. I met the England players a few years before I actually went into the film production. So I already knew some of the 1971 team before I actually met the film team. For me, that was always going to be the way that we were going to research this World Cup, was through the players, you know, the ones that actually lived it. So I already knew quite a lot before we actually went into production of the film. And then through those players, we got in touch with the other players. And actually, there was kind of like a few different ways that we did the main research. And actually, yeah, like, so I was the researcher on the film, but we were a really small team that actually worked on this full time for that year. There was maybe like 6 of us on it full time. So we did a lot of research through the players, a lot of basically like phone conversations, going to the house, sitting with them, having a cup of tea and hearing about everything they remember from this World Cup. And we did that in England. And then we went out to Mexico, Italy, France, Denmark. We didn't go to Argentina. We did that remotely. They were the 6 teams that took part: England, Mexico, Argentina, France, Denmark and Italy. A big part of my role was the Mexican newspapers. So all of the women that took part in this tournament brought like newspaper cuttings home with them, because they were all over the newspapers. Like, the coverage of this tournament was unbelievable. And I basically spent days and days, months reading through these newspapers that they'd brought home and picking out like the match report, like when was the goal scored, who scored the goal, what was said about the match, to try and piece together. Like, we ended up with like a calendar of the month that was the tournament in August 71. What happened on each day, where all the teams were, everything that happened around the football. So that was like a big part of it as well, the archive. And then we got hold of the footage. So that was where we started to be able to, piece together what the film was going to be. We wanted the film to be told by all 6 countries, so it wasn't just focused on England. The film is told by like women from all of the countries, and it was a bit of like a jigsaw puzzle, and I was not responsible for actually bringing it all together. That's what the directors do, choosing which bits go in and which bits don't go in. That was such a hard task, I know, because we interviewed all of the England players, for example. There's 14 of them, and then a lot of players from the other countries. Each of them has unbelievable stories that could be films on their own. But trying to fit all of that into 90 minutes without it being overwhelming was probably the hardest thing about this task. And another thing, which I think you mentioned, was, when the women got back, speaking about the England team now, when the women got back from Mexico, they'd gone out under the national ban of women's football. So in 71, women were still not allowed to play in affiliated stadiums. So any like official registered stadium, women couldn't play in it. And so when the tournament organisers came and approached England for a team, what was at the time the Women's Football Association said, we're not sending a team out, this is not an official World Cup, we don't even have an official England team because we don't play women's football in this country. So the WFA, the Women's Football Association, said no at the time, and the tournament organisers approached a man called Harry Batt, who was the coach of the England team, this England team that went out. Harry was essentially like a grassroots coach, but he was really well travelled. He'd done a lot of tournaments. He was actually a bus driver. That was his proper job, his full-time job. But he was passionate about women's football and well connected. And he travelled up and down the country, put a team together and took them out to this tournament in the World Cup. But because the women had gone out, and according to the WFA, they shouldn't have, when they got back, they were all banned from going back to literally their local grassroots club. They had letters home saying, like, don't go back to your, don't play football, basically, for a certain amount of time, depending on how old each of them were. And then some of them suffered more, like, were subject to humiliation. If anyone's seen the film, you'll see about Carol's story. Sorry, I could literally talk about this forever. Anyway, like, they had a really tough time. So actually, when we did approach the women and wanted to, you know, hear about their stories, it wasn't always as easy as, oh yeah, like, hey, I'll tell you everything. Because a lot of the women had suffered a lot of, firstly, they hadn't spoken about it for nearly 50 years because they were shamed into thinking that what they'd done was wrong. And so 50 years later, starting to talk about your story to a film production company that you don't know was not that straightforward. So there was a lot of, like, time and relationship building involved in basically getting the women to feel comfortable to tell their story to us.
Yeah, because you excuse me, so hay fever's killing me now, this is a thing, but I'm also just intrigued by all this, because it's really, we could talk this for about another 3 hours about different things, but just this obviously led to a lot of kind of movements, you know, and you've got now, you know, a lot of, you know, girls and women playing football because of this, you know, this movement, but also just different things have happened, you know, in the last 10, 15 years, you know, different, you know, you've got more kind of famous people, you know, coming out, but also you've got, you know, obviously the success of the Lionesses, but also the UK too. There's, like, been a lot of, you know, like, incredible players, you know, then, but do you look at, maybe look at Serena Wiegman, you know, how incredible she's been, you know, with the women's side. I read a book, it was incredible, you know, the challenges that they put together, you know, to, but the vulnerability, you know, like, being a vulnerable as a coach. It's I'm just looking at you, obviously you said you've mentioned you were in you've done a lot of kind of grassroots football. Do you think having this movement has helped you become clearer of what you've achieved, but also what you can achieve working in the kind of girls and women's game? And the second part is, yeah, you know, we talked kind of off air about the kind of the WSL, the kind of bigger kind of leagues, but also the commercial side. You know, do you think that there's not enough money getting trickled down to grassroots, so therefore sometimes the people that are good enough, you know, are complete at a higher level, just might not get the chance because A, due to finance, and B, maybe due to, you know, social kind of barriers.
So, yeah, firstly, I think having women like Serena, those, like, positive, visible role models in football is huge and has contributed massively to where we are today. In terms of, you know, you spoke about the Lionesses, and since the Lionesses won the Euros in 22, I think the change that we've seen there is irreversible. Like, it's been a huge step in the right direction, although I don't think we're where we need to be yet, because I think we need to be more sustainable in terms of women's football. But anyway, I think having women like Serena there has been, it's basically somebody that you can kind of look up to and pinpoint and say, like, yeah, especially for coaches, you know, I coach, but it's not like my career, I don't want to be a professional football coach, but actually I know having women like Serena is really important for a lot of grassroots football coaches. And not only having women like Serena, but actually having, for example, the Lionesses and just the national teams that are now have that visibility and there's more publicity around them, I think that's a huge thing for the girls at grassroots. Like, I see that every day in terms of, like, my work, because just over the last, like, 2-3 years, there's been a shift where the girls would used to come with the, say, England shirt or Man United shirt or whatever, with the men's team on the back, the name on the back, and actually that's not the case anymore. Like, the majority of the girls have got their favourite female player on the back of the shirt, which is, like, a historical change that we've not seen before, because women and girls haven't had those female role models in top flight football before. So I think that's a massive shift, a hugely positive one, that we like we have the visibility, the increased visibility of football to thank for that shift. But in terms of the money trickling down to grassroots, it's a tough one. Like, and also this is not my area of expertise. I can only speak for my experience in grassroots football and what I see. Like, I do a bit of work with Manchester Football Association as well, so with a few clubs across Manchester. I still feel like there's not even loads of money going in at the top to be able to trickle down. But I think everything is just so far behind where men's football is. And we shouldn't even really compare the women's football model with the men's football model. But nothing is as established as in the men's game. So even our own pathways are not as established. So like talent pathways for girls and things like that are relatively new. And like a lot of coaches that are coming into the game are coming in now that we've got all of these visible role models, but are also new into the game. So the pool of everyone working in the game is much smaller because it's such a more, the popularity has been so recent. So I just think that there's steps that still need to be taken. But I mentioned earlier about like the sustainability of women's football. And I think that it's something that's grown so quickly in such a short space of time that we just need to make sure that it continues to be sustainable. Because like, for example, I went to the Man City, Man United derby like 2 weeks ago. You could get a ticket for like £5. So it's really good that we fill stadiums. It's so important that we do, because then on the TV we have visibility and the women should be able to play in the main stadia. But actually, that's not sustainable. Charging £5 for a ticket to watch a derby isn't a sustainable price in terms of trying to inject the money back into, you know, having the money for the ticket sales that can go back into women's football, because a lot of female footballers make more money off pitch than on pitch, so through like brand deals and stuff like that rather than on pitch. That's really different to men's football, so I think it's a completely different product, but we just need to make sure it's developing at a sustainable rate.
Yeah, and we've only got a couple of minutes, so I just wanted to ask a final question on, you know, we talked about mindset, you know, throughout this, you know, in a kind of theme of like research to learning about different, you know, different people, but how would you describe your mindset? And also the biggest buzzwords right now are like high performance, you know, like, do you think that high performance can be led by anyone in any level, you know, like everyone looks like footballers or coaches, but also it could just be a mum, you know, or a dad, or, you know, a person who works in a shop, you know, because they're doing their, basically helping out. First question is, how would you describe your kind of mindset? And second, do you think high performance can be led by anyone?
Mm-hmm. I'll describe my mindset as generally like, more like how I describe myself as like positive, and also, I guess, passionate. Yeah. Like, I genuinely care about everything I do a lot, and that's what drives what I do, everything that I do and everything that I don't do actually as well. So that's the most important thing to me, like finding what you genuinely care about and letting that sort of guide your decisions. In terms of high performance, yeah, I think you made a really good point where you mentioned about parents. I don't think high performance needs to be like, for example, Super League or Premier League or top level coach or players, although obviously we see it there, it's visible there. I think it's about the right environment and the right behaviours and the people that are, if we're talking about, for example, children and young people and high performance, how is like that, for example, the primary caregiver or whoever it is, what are they doing? What are the little steps that they can take? Of course, they can support high performance. I think there's small steps that you can make at every level of, you can be a high performer grassroots football, you don't have to be professional football, and I think it's a really important mentality to maintain and something that anyone can support.
No, thank you again, Ella, for talking to me.
Thank you for having me.